It is the 21st of August, in the year 2002. We are continuing our study of Megillah. We are on Daf Chof Beis Omid Aleph, in other words, 22a. Last week, we dealt with various subjects, but primarily the problem that we dealt with, well, actually, let's put down two major topics. One was very, very brief. And it followed the discussion of what we had had previously, where we learned in the Mishnah that the first person to get an aliyah recites the bracha before the reading of the Torah, and the last person to get the aliyah recites the bracha after the reading of the Torah. So the question is, that we came across last week, why did we make a change so that today the person who has the aliyah recites both the blessing before the aliyah and also after the aliyah? And we said, I mean, the basic reason is for a very strange reason, and that is the question of nichnosin and yotzin. Nichnosin are people who come late to shul, and yotzin are people who leave early from shul. Okay, so that they should not feel that only one bracha is to be recited, and so therefore we recite, each one who has the aliyah has to recite both the beginning bracha and the concluding bracha. Okay, so God's fine.
Mostly for appearance.
Huh? You say appearance, all right. The point is that people should not get the wrong impression as to whether a bracha was made or a bracha was not made. That's what the idea is. Right. Yeah. However, as I told you, in reality today we have a more practical reason, because in those days everybody technically who got an aliyah was supposed to be able to read his portion. You understand? Whereas today we know that the overwhelming majority of people who get aliyahs are not capable of reading a selection of the Torah. Our great sins, our education hasn't progressed to that point where anybody could automatically get an aliyah and so on. I'm happy to say that at least in Kadima, we're trying to develop a group of people, you know, who will be able at least to prepare part of a Sedra reading. Yes?
I wouldn't even think it would enter the common person's mind that they were skipping brachos in the synagogue of the Torah.
You ask a good question, but the answer is that in those days they watched very carefully what was going on in the shul, and therefore they, you know, the impression might have been gained, you know, that they only have one bracha or only have another bracha. Well, that also, the same business about the Yosef Nichnosen entered into a discussion of something else, plus lots of other reasons, namely, we learned, first of all, that on an ordinary reading, which means Monday and Thursday morning, and Shabbos to Mincha, we have just how many aliyahs? Three aliyahs. We learned that. Okay. And a couple of weeks ago, we learned what does three represent? You know, like Echad Miyodea, you know, so three represents Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, or it stands for Kahanim, Levim, and Yisraelim, or whatever it may be. Okay. And then we also learned that a minimum of 10 psukim have to be read when we read the Torah. Okay, a minimum of 10 psukim. So what does the 10 correspond? So we said, okay, like for example, the 10 commandments, okay, or the 10 words of the Rabbeinu Shalom in creating the world, and the question was raised, but we only have 9 mayomers in the first parak, so the answer is, but Bereshis also represents that, because as the psalmist says, Midvar Hashem Rishayim Nasim, that the heavens themselves were created by the word of God. So that counts for 10. Okay. And then, of course, we came into a practical problem towards the end of last week's session, in which we had to grab a chumash, everybody, and we had to dissect it very, very carefully. And that is the problem that was raised about what is the reading for Rosh Chodesh. Okay. The reading of the Torah for Rosh Chodesh. Okay. First of all, general rule, we learned that on a day upon which Musaf is recited, namely Rosh Chodesh or Chol HaMoed, okay, then in those particular days we have to have 4 aliyahs and not 3. Okay. So, in the case of Chol HaMoed, we didn't even discuss that, but that's easy because you don't have a problem that arises with the reading of Rosh Chodesh. In other words, normally there are enough psukim so that you can divide it and get 3 aliyahs, 4 aliyahs out of it without any great difficulty, okay? Although I have to tell you, it's not as easy as that either, but, you know, it's all been worked out, okay? However, with Rosh Chodesh, we discovered that there are, in the first section, only 8 psukim. So the question is, how do you divide it without violating other laws that we learned, namely that you must always leave at least 3 psukim in a portion, okay? At least 3 psukim in a portion. So how do we divide it? So one suggestion was that maybe 4 and 4, maybe read from another passage, and so on and so forth. But these didn't work out. Okay. So essentially we learned that there was a difference of opinion between two great authorities who were contemporary in Babylonia, Rav and Shmuel. Okay? Rav said that the solution to the problem is to reread one of the psukim. If we do that, he said, then we can have 9 psukim that way instead of 8. Okay? Sounds good, okay? Shmuel, on the other hand... Shmuel, on the other hand, had a different problem. His problem was, he says, no, that's not right. I have a better solution, he said. My solution is posek. What does posek mean? Posek means that we'll stop one of the verses in the middle and say that that counts as a verse, and then the rest of the verse counts as a whole verse. Smart, right? Okay.
Divide and conquer.
You're right. So I don't want to go through the whole thing all over again, but all of these things came into play when we learned last week. And anybody who wants to borrow the tape and listen to it, I think you'll find it extremely instructive. Okay. And then we pointed out at the very end, we spoke about the fact that what did we say the halacha is? The halacha is that we follow in this case Rav, namely we repeat a pasuk. Okay? Plus a supplementary teaching that we had, another halacha, namely that it's one of the middle aliyahs wherein this takes place. It cannot take place in the first aliyah, nor in the last aliyah, but it has to take place in one of the middle aliyahs. Naturally, there are 2 middle ones, okay? So I pointed out that in reality, our practice is to follow, you know, the Doleg, but that the Vilna Gaon had a somewhat different practice, but nevertheless, in our shuls, by and large, we follow the practice that we do over here in Kadima, namely that the third posuk, this is reread as the beginning of the second aliyah, and then we continue with 2 more psukim, and so on. And that's how we get through the first passage, which is Salvis Bnei Israel. Okay. And.
That's okay with me.
Thank you.
Right.
So it happens to be in this case the second aliyah.
What is the reason? Yeah. It's like a sandwich. What is the reason?
Why didn't we accept Shmuel's halacha? Right. You mean? The answer is very simple. Because there was a feeling that if Moshe Rabbeinu did not make this a pasuk, we do not have the right to break it up into 2 psukim. Okay? Whatever pasuk Moshe Rabbeinu made in the reading of the Torah, you don't come and farbesser and make it into 2. Okay, that's the reason why. Yes. Yeah.
The halacha, we have to do 10 verses or at least 10 verses?
At least 10 verses.
So what's the problem?
No, the problem was how to cut up the aliyah. There are more than 10 verses that we read on Rosh Chodesh. But the question is, how do you divide up the paragraph and not do violence to the fact that you have to be able to leave a couple, to leave at least 3 psukim. If you do it 3, 3, then what's left? 2. do 4 and 4, and then what are we going to do at that particular point? If we read the next passage of Yom HaShabbos, there are only 2 psukim over there, and there has to be at least how many psukim? At least 3. You need at least 3 psukim, and you must also, as I say, have at least 3 psukim before the end of a passage. Okay, so that all these, you know, they all play a role in how we have to determine how to read. And as I pointed out too, when I have the problem of having additional aliyahs on Shabbos, yeah, then in that particular case I have to be very judicious as to where I stop. I cannot stop, let's say, 2 psukim for the end of a section in the Torah. I can't do it. Okay, there are other rules too, as for example with Maftir, that the Akhrit and Maftir is a normal rule, should not be the same. So certain days we do not have an Akhram, period, because that would be a violation of that. Okay, Shvi and Maftir, yes, but not Akhrit and Maftir. So I have to tell Sam sometimes in advance, only 7 aliyahs today, don't add any more. Okay, yes. You have to be judicious in how you add. Okay?
I noticed this shot, we don't end in Shani. We're reading on the weekdays,
you need more psukim, exactly. That's exactly what it is. Right. Yeah.
The division with the Pesachim and all of that. He said that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't get
punctuated. Yeah, that's what the Gemara says, right.
There was no punctuation. Am I correct about that?
Well, but there was an oral tradition as to what the Pesach was.
Okay.
Moshe, okay, he wrote it down, but also he had to teach it orally to other people.
Right.
He had to teach it, okay.
So there's a knowledge of where the...
Yeah.
Where the punctuation
right.
has been.
Yeah, by tradition. After Moshe Rabbeinu received his communications from the Rebbeinu Shalalem, then he called in Yehoshua, and said, he called in, let's say, his brother Aaron, if he was still alive, okay? And then they in turn were supposed to transmit this, teach it, you know, to the heads of the various tribes, and then the tribes, you know, taught it to their own people and so on. So this is how the tradition came down. Okay.
So when it came to the time when they actually put in the punctuation
came in much later. Right.
But they knew the tradition.
Right, by tradition they knew what the psukim were. Right. Punctuation didn't actually begin until some say 7th century, something like that. Okay.
The common era?
The common era, right. But nevertheless... Huh? No. That's grammar. Nikud. Nikud. Yeah.
You plan out all your aliyahs ahead of time for Shabbat?
Right. First of all, the Chumash already has the portion. Okay. But if it's extra, then I have to plan in advance. Exactly. It's exactly what I do. Right. Look, it's important to me. I do not come into shul without having looked through the Sedrach beforehand. Even though I could probably do a good deal of it by heart without preparation, but it's not right. I have to review, I have to prepare, and at the same time I take a look already to see what would be, you know, possible places in which we could have. Okay.
Are the aliyahs planned, or are they just given to you?
No, I mean, you know, Sam. Sam is the boss of that. I have nothing to do with who gets the leaders. Okay.
Membership. Some people complain I don't get an affiliate.
Right.
They tell them, get in touch with your Gabbai. You're going up. You have there's various ways that the Gabbai is usually circulating. I've seen in any show.
Look for the person. You don't know it, Sam.
No, I don't know who Sam is going to call up. Okay.
At least bringing out the order of things. That's why the Kohen goes first. You have the Kohen that can go Achron.
Okay, let me get my big Gemara, and we shall start now with the new section where we left off last week. Okay.
He even figured out how to throw the Kohens out so that the Levi can go first.
Oh, really?
There's no Kohen here.
Oh, it says no Kohen.
If there is no Kohen, then it's customary to call a Levi, but
okay.
You don't have to.
There's no Levi, a Kohen.
The Kohen is called up, and there is no Levi, then the Kohen has to get a double a Levi. You have all kinds of laws, you know, that deal with the reading of the Torah.
There is a possibility that there are only 10 Kohanim.
I find according to the Gemara, yes. But in that case, each one gets the Levi.
And if there's no Kohen and no Levi, is that a possibility?
Of course, that happens very often. After all, the majority of people are Yisraelim, they're not the Kohanim or Levi.
Yeah, I do.
Okay. All right. So, we are now, I'll tell you where we are. Yes, the last thing that we heard on the previous tape was Yilchasot Deleif Yem Tzeridolka. Namely, that the halacha says that we repeat the verse, and also it is one of the middle aliyahs in which we perform this rereading of the verse. Okay. So, we now continue the analysis of the Mishnah, and we're up to where it says Zehah Klal, Kol Sheyesh Bo Musaf, etc. Okay? Does everybody see it? No.
Yeah. Oh,
it's the first long line.
Sam, where?
Second long line.
Where?
See the long lines?
Yeah.
Okay.
The rubber?
No, 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 no. It says Zehah Klal, which means this is the general rule.
I got it.
Kol Sheyesh Bo Musaf. Right, wherever we have a day in which Musaf is recited, right?
Yeah.
As for example, Rosh Chodesh and Rosh Chodesh, so then we have to call up four people. So this is already what? An addition to what? To three, we add one. Okay? Now, in the section, what we'll be learning tonight is an explanation of why the Mishnah said that on a Yom Tov, we call five people, right? On Yom Kippur, we call six people. On Shabbos, we call seven people. And why that? But they're not finished yet with the analysis of what we do on those days where we said Musaf is read, namely Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed, right? And we said we have four aliyahs. So now the question is, one thing that was not discussed was, well, how about on a tiny sibur, on a fast day? How many people do we call up to the reading of the Torah on that day? Because it's a mitzvah to read. As a matter of fact, on the tinus we read, first of all, in the morning, as part of chakra service, and then we read it again in mincha, okay, on the fast day. So that being the case, the question is, how many of these do we have? This is what they want to discuss at this particular moment. Okay? Says the boiler. Following question was raised. Okay? Not sure where was it raised. It was raised in the yeshiva, right? Says, Tanis Sibur Bechama. Okay? How many aliyahs should we have on a public fast day? Okay? Rosh Chodesh Moed, right? Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed, the Yirko Kabbal Musaf, right? In those days, they would offer an additional sacrifice besides the regular daily sacrifice, right? So we learn that on those days, Arba'ah, we have to call up four people. Aval Hocha, the lack of Kabbal Musaf, low, but in our case, namely in a public fast day, right? Where we do not have the offering of an additional sacrifice, we should say no. In other words, not four people. Oh, Dilmor, or maybe Hochanami, Yikar Musa Tefila. Maybe we should call up four people on a fast day, because what we're doing is to add additional prayers on that particular day. Remember when we learned Tractate Titus several years ago, okay? at that particular point, we learned that, for example, there are public fast days, as for example, days that were established in order to pray to God in case there was a lack of rain. Okay? And we learned that, that there was various things that did. There was fasting, there were special prayers, and so on and so forth. To this day, we still retain, and also we learned that in the most serious cases, they would actually bring the Oren Kodesh out into the public square, and they would preach unto them, you know, words to get people, you know, to commit themselves to tshuva, you know, to repentance and so on, and there were special blessings that were added to the Shmona Esrei. Okay. Of those special blessings, we have one that still is retained to this very day on a fast day. We have a prayer which begins with the words, Adenu Ad Hashem, Adenu B'Yom Tzom Tan Nisenu. Answer us, O Lord, the day of our fasting, because we are the great sorrows. And don't turn, you know, to our wickedness, but have mercy upon us, etc., etc., and answer our prayers even before you know, we pray unto you. In other words, you should already be disposed to answer favorably what we are asking you. And the Baruch Ato Hashem, Ho'ino B'Yisora. Blessed about thou, O Lord, who answers us in a time of trouble. This is a separate bracha. Well, when we say the prayer silently, Shmoneh Esrei silently, right? So we say Anenu is part of the Shmar Kaleinu and do not make a separate bracha. But when we have Hazoras Hashatz, in other words, when the person who is leading the congregation in prayer recites aloud again the Shmoneh Esrei, you know, what we call Hazoras Hashatz, in other words, repetition, that the, literally, the emissary of the congregation recites, right, the Shatz being whoever is up at the oven over there, so he adds a separate bracha to it, okay? There are also, in addition, various slichos, various prayers of penitence that very often are added. In many shuls, there's a whole series of slichos which is similar to the slichos that we recite, that we will be reciting very shortly every morning in shul over here, between the beginning of the first slichos, which would be on Sunday prior to Labor Day, Saturday night, okay? And then right through until Erev Yom Kippur we recite them, except on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Actually, in Yom Kippur too, part of the prayer is actually a slichus too that we say, okay? So, there are, in other words, additional prayers, right? So, the question now that is being phrased is, inasmuch as we have additional prayers, it's like Musaf Tfilos, right? Not Musaf Korbonos, it's not the sacrifice, an additional sacrifice, but it is additional prayers that we add. So why shouldn't we read four aliyahs instead of three aliyahs? This is what the question is. Okay. You understand? This is the question now. So Toshma. So now the Gemara tries to come up with an answer. It says, Beroshi. Yes. Yes. We are on Chof Beis Omid Aleph. Okay, we started with the long lines on the page. So okay. Chof Beis Omid Aleph.
Yes.
Okay, you see the long lines?
Yes, sure.
Okay. Okay, all right. We are now on the fourth line of that. I have already phrased, you know, what the question is. The question is, huh? No.
Four down.
Four down.
Four down and the full lines.
Okay.
Yeah, the right page. Chof Beis. Right. Okay. All right. Yeah. So, we want to try to solve this question. Shall we say that on a fast day, we should have four aliyahs instead of three aliyahs, right? Inasmuch as we add Musaf Tfilos, okay? Musaf Tfilos. Additional prayers. So, Toshma. So now they want to give an answer to this question. They say, listen, Rosh Chodesh and Mechulei Shel Moed, right? On Rosh Chodesh days and on Chol Hamoed days, Korin Arba'ah, right? We read four. But Ha B'Ta'anis Tzibur Gimel. But however, on a public fast day, we only read three of these. Okay? So, Eimor Reisha B'Shin Rachamisha B'Shabbos B'Mincha Korin Gimel Hotanis Tzibur Arba'ah. So, I might say, look, the beginning of the Mishnah, which we are busy analyzing right now, it stressed the fact that on Monday and Thursday, and Shabbos to Mincha, we read three, right? So why shouldn't we, on a fast day, read four in order to make it, you know, more important? You understand? That's what the question. So the Gemara says, No, it says, this kind of reasoning, it won't work in this particular session. Okay? It's not going to work. So Tashma. So now here, a nice one that happened. The Rav Iklal Lebovil B'Tanis Sibur. Rav went back to Babylonia from Eretz Israel, and he happened to come into a shul on a fast day, okay? Public fast day. Come, so he arose, Korah B'Sifro, and he read in the Sefer Torah, right? Posach, he opened it, okay? Or it really means in this case, like he read the first Aliyah, right? And Borech, and he made the Bracha, of course, in that particular case. Chosim, and then when he concluded the reading of the day, the Lo Borech, he did not recite the Bracha that follows, right? But what did all the people do? So he says, Nofol Kuleyalman Paihu, Verav Lenofol Ape. Now, we have to this very day what we call the Filas Kapayim, okay? The Filas Apai, excuse me. Literally, it means that you fall on your face, okay? Uh-huh. That's what it means, literally. Yeah. However, what is it? In those days, when people came to what we call Tachnun, okay? What they actually did was to go down and prostrate themselves on the ground. That's why it's called the Filas Apai. Because they had their face on the ground, right? They fell with their face on the ground, okay? We only do it symbolically. So what do we do? What we do is, you know, like this, okay? You cover your face and it's as if, you know, you're reciting it, okay? But here in Babylonia at the time of Rav, remember that we're talking now about 1800 years ago, 1900 years ago, okay? Not talking about something that happened 2 days ago, okay? So, when Rav came to Babylonia, to this particular shul, so he didn't recite the bracha at the end. And in the meantime, what did everybody do? They all fell on their faces. They all came to recite Tachnun. The Rav, but Rav did not do so. So he says, Michti Rav Yisrael Korab, right? Inasmuch as Rav read the Torah in Israel, so my Tavo Chosam Leborich. So, for what reason then can we say that he concluded the reading of the Torah and he did not recite the Bracha afterwards, right? So, it has to be Lav Mishum Deboy the Mikri Achrinu Basre. He can only assume that there had to be somebody else who had an Aliyah after him, and as the Mishnah said, you know, at the beginning, only the last person is the one who recites the bracha that concludes, all right? So, it sounds good, all right? A good teretz, as we would say. So they say, lo, no. And I'll tell you why it's not so good, he says, because Rav v'kahane korah. Where did Rav read the Torah? He read it where in a portion that normally would be given to whom? To a kohen. Namely, first Aliyah, right? And yet, Rav was honored with this Aliyah. So, how come? So they say, okay, the whole Rav Kuna, Rav Huna, Kor B'Kahane. Okay. So, okay, he did that he got this first aliyah, just as, for example, Rav Huna, there was actually he was a little bit later than Rav, chronologically, okay? But they're taking the example of Rav Huna, who was a very, very important teacher of the Talmud, right? A very important Amora, as we would say. And they honored him by calling him first to the reading of the Torah, even though what? Even though he wasn't a Kohen. So Rav apparently was doing the same thing. So they say, okay, Mishnah, okay, Rav Huna Kori Bikahane, right? It's absolutely true that Rav Huna would get the first Aliyah, okay? The Ho Afilu Rav Ami Rav Asi the Kahane Chashivi the Arts Israel make of Kafir Day, the Rav Huna. Okay. The reason being that even Rav Ami and Rav Asi, who were Kohanim, they were Kohanim, great rabbis, great teachers, right? And they were not only that, but Chashivi the Arts Israel and the Eretz Israel, they were given the highest honors for their learning, but nevertheless, what about them? Ma'akav kaifu le'el Rav Huna. It is, they subordinated themselves to Rav Huna, and they said, in other words, Rav Huna is an even greater authority than we are.
Even though the other two were
even
not,
though both of them
present.
Were Kahanim, but
were not present,
well, I don't know, maybe they stepped out of the shul at that time. The guy
okay,
said, step
yeah,
out,
yeah.
Okay.
All right, yeah. Well, this is but, his recognition.
Right, but yeah. It's a market recognition, exactly. So, and then they say, not only that, but Ella Rav. Okay, back again to Rav. Ha, Iko Shmuel, the Kahana Hab. Okay? Okay. The Dabur Ale, okay, says, but how about Shmuel? Shmuel, his contemporary, and as I say, we notice we always have these arguments going on between whom? Between Rav and Shmuel, okay? So, Shmuel was a Kohen, and he should have been considered an equal to whom? To Rav, right? So how come, let's say, if Shmuel was present in the shul together with Rav, why didn't they call Shmuel and give him the first aliyah? Instead of giving it to whom? To Rav, right? So they say, Shmuel, let me make a Havakai play the Rav. So they say, Shmuel also felt that Rav was a greater Talmud Chochem than he was. Okay? Yes. Marty?
Does Rav usually pick up a lot of time in these debates?
Okay. The answer is that in most cases, the Halacha follows Rav rather than Shmuel. Say in most cases. There are cases where, of course, it's Shmuel's halacha, you know, that it's followed. Okay. But if we would, I guess, take statistics, so we would find that, generally speaking, more times that they agree with Rav rather than Shmuel. Okay? Yes?
The question I had was about if you could just tell me what Hebrew word is
Yeah. It's Aramaic. It's not really Hebrew. But I'll tell you. There is a root in Hebrew to Lachof es harosh means that also like you bow your head. It's related to the root, you know, like Zoke Kafufim and so on. See? What is Zoke Kafufim? God causes, you know, those who are bowed down to become erect. You understand? Yeah, so that's what it is. In other words, he bowed down before the presence of it. In other words, he recognized that the other one was even greater in rank than he. Yeah. Okay. But Rav, who the Yomad lay covered, but you know what? Rav nevertheless gave cover to whom? He gave cover to Shmuel. So v'chi avit le b'fonov, shalom b'fonov le avit le. Alright, so when did it happen, you know, that Rav would give honor to to Shmuel, it would be when the both of them were present. But Shalobi father of Leovid Leah, right? But this was not the case, you know, when Shmuel was not present at the same time that Rav was. Of course, by the way, they didn't live in the same city. They each had their own great yeshivas in different cities, okay?
In Babylonia?
In Babylonia, right. But sometimes, you know, it would happen that the two of them would be in the same place in order to discuss things and so on and so forth, okay?
And
so,
how would the halacha be determined between them? Do they have to face each other in the Sanhedrin?
How is the halacha determined? That's a very good question. The answer is, it's based upon the discussions that developed in the school of Rav, the school of Shmuel, and how the later authorities tried to straighten out, let's say, the differences of opinion between them, and to see, in general, what would be the prevailing practice, and so on. You understand?
What was such a thing as in their lifetime as a halacha between those schools? What they call their own custom?
Well, that would be an excellent question. I don't know whether, you know, generally speaking, those who were in the academy of Rav followed Rav, those who were in the academy of Shmuel followed Shmuel. But at a later time, that's when they tried to straighten out this particular problem as to who is the prevailing authority in this particular matter. Yes.
So it's not a question of a minhag anymore. In the final analysis,
eventually
became
halacha. Right. Eventually,
but at that time, it was almost like minhag.
In those days, I mean, each had their own interpretation. Right. I mean, we've had parallel things like that too. As for example, you know, in the very earliest group that we have, you know, we have differences of opinion. Would be, as for example, Hillel and Shammai. Okay, two very famous authorities, and then they had their schools, and you know, they each differed in their practice based upon whose halacha they followed. But eventually, as time went on, what happened? People accepted the halacha as practiced by Hillel in, let's say, 99 cases out of 100, as compared to what Shammai had to say. Okay? So, a similar thing happened, let's say, between Rabbi Yehuda Anasi and some of the other great authorities of his time. Rabbi Yehuda, for example, very often we follow his opinion rather than, you know, that of, let's say, of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi and so on. By Rabbi Yehuda is a different Rabbi Yehuda. It's not the same as Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, okay? So, and the same thing then followed, I mean, in a later period then with Rabbi Shmuel, right? And then later on, you have Rav Avi and Rav Asi, who were mentioned already over here too, you know, who were obviously disciples of Rav and Shmuel and things like that.
And so,
some
of them, say, 200 or 300 years or so.
This is a period of quite a few hundred years, right? Yeah, because Hillel and Shammai, they were just prior to the beginning of the Common Era, okay. But a later period, for example, Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, Rabbi Akiva, and so on, they were already, let's say, about the second century of the Common Era. You understand? So, and then, of course, as you go on, Rabbi Shmuel would be also roughly about the end of the second century, going to the third century, etc., etc. So, the Babylonian Talmud has a history up to about the first 500 years of the Common Era. Okay. The Palestinian Talmud came to an end earlier than that because the Christians persecuted the Jews to such an extent that most of the activity had to stop in Eretz Yisrael. So, okay, so they did what they did. Nevertheless, and I have to add too that normally, when we study Talmud, we are studying the Babylonian Talmud, which was considered the more authoritative of the two. But today, a lot of people now like to immerse themselves once more in the Talmud Yerushalmi, because in certain cases we can understand a problem that arises over here better from the perspective of the Yerushalmi.
would have been more immediate, would it not, because in 1 year.
Yeah, but again, there also, don't forget, however, there were differences of practice between what went on in Eretz Israel as compared to what went on in Babylonia. There were different minhagim. Yeah,
right.
There were different minhagim. Both of these places.
So you have to be a fundamentalist to go back to Yerushalayim.
Well, I wouldn't say a fundamentalist.
Well, you know what I'm saying.
The point is, what you'd want to do is, you know, to try to understand a problem better in the light of the authorities in Eretz Israel as compared to the authorities in Babylonia. As I say, in some cases, it's a better idea. Now, this already is not just today, because we find that already Rashi was doing the same thing. That probably the Rambam is doing the same thing, because they really immerse themselves in every branch of learning, whatever they could find, you see. But the tendency in the yeshivas was pretty much to concentrate on the Babylonian Talmud, and only, you know, those who wanted to, let's say, immerse themselves in more advanced learning. So they also decided, you know, to take a look at the Yerushalmi and see what the Yerushalmi has to say.
But
language in Yerushalmi is not easy, because it represents a somewhat different type of Aramaic as compared to the Aramaic that we have here in the Talmud.
But
yes.
Just the fact that they were in Eretz Israel, would that be any additional insight?
Yes.
No, that's
definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely it would be so, right.
And the Masechtas are parallel?
There are parallels. I mean, don't forget, they're all using the same Mishnah as the basis upon which to center the discussion. Okay? But what we find is that, for example, the Babylonian Talmud did not have tractates on many of the Mishnahs that we find in Seder Zeroyim, where it deals with all kinds of aspects of agricultural laws, including, you know, tithing and how you're leaving the quarter of the field and stuff like that and so on, and how do you fulfill this. The Yerushalmi has tractates on that. Bavli did not have it, okay? And another area in which the Bavli does not have is in the last section, what we call Taros. The Mishnah has tractate upon tractate of how it is possible to contract tumor. You understand? How this object could contract tumor, another object could contract tumor, and things like that, and so on. Or how people, for example, let's say, suffer from leprosy, or something like that. So these things would not really discussed fully in the Talmud Bavli. So the Rishalmi sometimes is a better help to us in these areas. Okay, but as I say, the average person, if he can even learn a little bit over here, he's already learning something. Okay, because we speak about this as being a Yam Shel Talmud. You know what a yam is? A sea. It's a notion of Talmud. So, you know, not everybody can dip in into the ocean and get everything that they possibly can. But you try.
Get your feet wet.
Not all are good swimmers.
No, right.
We lose a lot of material during the Middle Ages because of our persecution. There are a lot of
Galatians. No. There were some changes made in the text because of Christian persecution. For example, originally they had a mention of Yoshka in there, okay? So that was taken out. Why was it taken out? They didn't want to offend, first of all, the Christians. And secondly, the Christians were just looking for anything in order to pin blood libels and excite the masses to say, look, the Jews are blaspheming our, so and so forth, right? So some passages were changed, okay? Yeah. But essentially the text that we have in medieval manuscripts of the Talmud is similar to the text that we have today. There are some differences. I mean, this is why you have, for example, glosses on the side where they feel that the reading probably should better have been this and that or something like that. Yeah. you see all these little things on the side over here. So generally speaking, they are glosses. Okay. Or down at the bottom of the page, you have that, goes out of the Bach and so on and so forth. Okay. The Vilnigon did a lot of that. In our own time, even Moshe Feinstein, who the rabbi was talking about before, he also, you know, tried to include some of the glosses into the text of his own Talmud, and theoretically some of the newer editions carry some of the suggestions that Rav Moshe made. All right, but essentially what we have over here is what we've had for quite a few centuries, okay? All right, getting back over here. All right, so we see then, first of all then that Rav got this aliyah, right? And the question is, did anybody follow him? Maybe that's why he did not. We're at the very bottom of the page. Okay, so we see that Shmuel gave honor to Rav, but at the same time Rav wanted to honor Shmuel this way. Okay? So, Ochinami Mistabra, the one in the second life at the bottom, right? So, in this case too, it makes sense, the Rav Bekahane Korah, right? That Rav actually read the first Aliyah in place of what? In place of a Kohen. That they honored him by giving him this first Aliyah. The Yisalkut Datach Be Yisrael Korah, because if your opinion is that he read it as the third Aliyah, as, you know, Kohen, Levi, Yisrael, alright, so if we are to assume that he read it as the third Aliyah, as the Yisrael, right, then my Tava Borech, then if that's the case, why did he make the bracha before? So if we say La Achat HaKona, maybe it's because of the fact, you know, that this was after they made the change to say that you have to make the bracha before and after. So it says, Yehochi, if that's the case, so why didn't he make the bracha following the reading of the Torah? So they say, Shani Hecho de Yosef Rav the Beard Island. So, yeah, we need the next page now. All right. So it says this is a little bit different, right? And because Rav sat, and he sat, so to speak, you know, on a higher position, right? Yeah, we are now on Chof. Yes, we do. That's the next one. You see, it's marked 44 on the. 44. Right, okay. So, yeah, so what they're trying to say, what they're trying to say is maybe people came in late after Rav started in to read, okay, but basically nothing. They would not leave earlier than before he had finished the reading. So therefore, according to Rashi, he made the bracha beforehand, right? So this is for the sake of the people who came in late, so they should know, you know, that he made a bracha before reading the Torah, but he didn't have to do it afterwards because he was not concerned that people would leave before, and that's why he didn't do it. Okay. But needless to say, Rav is Rav, but what we do is not exactly the same as what Rav did. We follow the halacha that says, you know, the takana, which says that when you read an aliyah, you have to make a bracha beforehand and a bracha afterwards. So the fact that Rav is not concerned that people would be leaving early, this didn't matter to him because he did not have that particular minhag at this time. Okay. All right. So now we get back again. So toshma. That being the case, zaklo. Okay. This should be the general rule. It says kol sheyesh bo bitul melacha la'am kiron tanis tibur tishba of korin gimel. Say first of all, on a day when a public fast is proclaimed and people did not go to work, in those days, you know, people did not work on certain fast days because they wanted to involve the entire community, as we learned in Titus, you know, that they wanted to involve everybody in tshuva and in prayer and so on and so forth, so that the Rebbeinu Shalom should have mercy upon us and remove the tzara, whatever it is that we're praying to him for, okay? So, in that particular case, on those days and on Tisha B'Av, Korin Gimel, we have how many aliyahs? We read three. V'she'ein bo bitul melacha la'am, but on days in which there is no cessation of work for the people, kigon, for example, Rosh Chodesh, Rosh Chodesh, Mechudosh Moed, Korin Dalet. So, this doesn't make very much sense, I have to tell you, okay? For the simple reason that they're giving an answer over here which doesn't quite fit the bill. Why? Here they are assuming, according to this, that on Chol HaMoed people go to work. The truth of the matter is that on Chol HaMoed you're not supposed to go to work, supposed to enjoy Yontif on those days, but there are some exceptions that are made. As for example, if it's necessary for the public welfare, then you could go to work on that day. So that would be the reason why, for example, a bus driver is permitted to drive a bus on Chol HaMoed, so that people can go, you know, on Chol HaMoed and enjoy themselves, to go whatever it has to be, and so on. You understand? Because it's not the major holiday, nor is it Shabbos, you see. But this is why I'm not altogether certain that this is a very good reason. We have a better reason. Better reason being that the additional prayers that are said they're not exactly in the same category as an additional sacrifice that took place on the Beis HaMikdash. And that's the reason why on Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed we read four and not on the Tanis Sibur when we read three. However, we're not finished with Tanis Sibur. Okay. Shema minam. Yeah. So Amar Rav Ashi. So Rav Ashi said, "Anan le tanan hochi. We never learned anything like this. Zaklo. This is the ruling. What? Called Yom Sheyesh Bei Musaf. The Yeno Yom Tov.